From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Murder Ball, a new documentary about an extreme sport played by people who can no longer walk, quadriplegics who get around the court in wheelchairs that look like they're from a Mad Max movie. This full-contact sport is a cross between rugby, soccer, basketball, and bumper cars. We'll talk with Dana Adam Shapiro, the co-director and co-producer of the film, and Mark Zupan, one of the game's top players. Also, we talk with comic book artist and screenwriter Daniel Clowes. The movie Ghost World was based on his comic book series of the same name. He has a new comic strip novel called Ice Haven, partially inspired by the Leopold and Loeb story and the play Our Town, and populated by an assortment of oddly behaving characters. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A new documentary is about a sport so fierce it was originally known as murder ball. It's an extreme sport played by men who can no longer walk, quadriplegics who get around the court in specially designed wheelchairs. Murder ball, better known now by the more socially acceptable name quad rugby, is a hybrid of rugby, soccer, basketball, and bumper cars. It's a full contact sport. Opposing players often intentionally crash into each other and sometimes overturn in their chairs. The new documentary, Murder Ball, opening in theaters next month, begins at the 2002 World Championship in Sweden and follows members of Team America and their chief rival Team Canada as they prepare for the 2004 Paralympic Games in Athens. Here's some of the men whose stories are followed.
I've been out in clubs, I've been out all over the place, and people will come up to me and they'll shake my hand and say, "Oh, it's good to see you out." And I look at him like, "Good to see me out. You know, like, where am I supposed to be? In a closet hanging out?"
What I can do, what probably people don't think I can do, is I can cook and I can drive. I might not be a great cook, I might not be a great driver, but I can do both.
People say some of the dumbest things. Like, I'll be at the grocery store loading the groceries into my car, and people are like, and then I go to get my car, and like, "Well, do you need help in your car?" It's like, well, I wouldn't have come to the grocery store if I couldn't get back in my car.
I've gone up to people, start talking shit, and they're like, "Oh," I go, "What? You're not gonna hit a kid in a chair? Fuck, hit me. I'll hit you back."
The last person we heard from, Mark Zupan, one of the top American players, is pretty intimidating on the court. Zupan is my guest, along with Dana Adam Shapiro, who co-directed the film Murder Ball with Henry Alex Rubin. Shapiro first learned about quad rugby when he read about it in a newspaper article. I asked Shapiro why he wanted to make a film about the sport.
I think it was the quad and the rugby together in one sentence that was pretty jarring. I had always thought that a quad was like Christopher Reeve. I guess for better or for worse, he was the poster boy for quadriplegia. And when I read this article, I guess all my stereotypes started to crumble. They were talking about this game that they play on a basketball court in these armor-plated wheelchairs, and it's full contact, and guys flip over, and I just didn't think that was possible. You know, I thought that most quadriplegics were at home under a blanket, kind of drinking their food and having a powered wheelchair.
Mark, since you play it and play it so well, would you first of all describe the special chairs that you play rugby in?
The chairs are nothing like you would see, say, at an airport or everyday life. It weighs probably about 30, 35 pounds. It's just reinforced considerably more than an everyday chair. We're strapped into the chair, so if you get hit and you do end up flipping over, the chair's coming with you, so it's not like we're being launched or we're not projectiles. The wheels are angled out, which is called camber. There's more camber, so it turns quickly. It's pretty much a reinforced chair. It looks like something out of a Mad Max film.
It almost looks like a wheelchair as an armored vehicle.
That's exactly. I mean, that's a great description of it. And it's so hard to put it into words.
And you kind of need that armor because you're crashing into other people on the court, and they're crashing into you, which leads to one of the most baffling things to me as I was watching it. You know, I would think, because this is the way my mind works, I would think that if you had a neck injury that left you a quad, that you'd want to protect the rest of your body, and that the last thing you'd want is to be tipped over on your head or your back in a wheelchair, risking, like, breaking an arm or, you know, breaking a limb that still, is functioning for you.
That's a big misconception. Now, we are just like anyone else. We're not fragile. We're not, made up of... We don't have to be careful. My neck right now is probably stronger than it was beforehand. So that's what's so good about the film, because it addresses that, and it pretty much expresses that, hey, I'm no different than anyone else. I just sit down.
Mark, would you describe, like, without getting too technical about the rules of the game, how the sport is played?
Sure. It's played on a basketball court. There's four people per team on the court. Your total point value cannot be greater than 8 points on the floor. Everyone's given a point value depending upon their disability. It starts out at 0.5 and it goes to 3.5 in increments of 0.5, so you put any combination there. You have to inbound the ball within 10 seconds. It starts pretty much like basketball. You score a goal, you inbound the ball, you have 10 seconds to inbound the ball, you have 15 seconds to go over half court, and every 10 seconds you either have to pass or dribble, and that's pretty much the basics. You have to, you're scoring with the ball on your lap between two cones at the other end, which is, it's through a key which would be a little bit wider than a basketball key, but a lot, it's not as deep. It's about a yard and a half deep.
Dana, when you were directing Murder Ball, how did you position the camera to really get a sense of the drama of the game? I mean, you play around with the camera and even with the speed of the camera in showing the game.
Right. Well, there's two directors, myself and Henry Alex Rubin, and Henry shot the film, and we decided on an aesthetic very early on, which was that we didn't want to shoot this film from the fly on the wall's perspective. You know, we didn't want to shoot this film in wide. We wanted to shoot it much more subjectively from the subject's point of view. The film was really supposed to be and is supposed to be, you know, a movie about what it's like to break your neck, not what's it like to be in the room with a guy who breaks their neck. So, you know, the film is shot almost primarily from the wheelchair point of view. It's literally like I would push Henry around in a wheelchair, and he had the camera in his lap, and you know, we always were sort of holding it down so that it was this is their point of view in the world. And Zupan talks that he'll, you know, he sees your butt before he sees your face. So that's sort of the only difference. And there was cameras that were strapped under the wheelchairs, on top of the wheelchairs. Those portraits were set up and then sped up in the editing room when you see sort of like Team USA or Team Canada and the cameras zooms in. But, yeah, I mean, for the most part, we just really wanted to shoot it much more subjectively to try to make it look more like a feature film as opposed to a documentary.
Mark, how were you injured?
I was 18 years old, and I was playing college soccer. We went out after we won a game and went to the bar. Drank too much, so wandered out of the bar and passed out in my buddy's pickup truck. He came out of the bar, I don't know, a couple hours later, left to go home and got lost. So he was driving south on I-95 in Florida. He spun out and threw me out of the back of a pickup truck, over a fence, over some trees, into a canal where I spent 14 hours in a canal hanging onto a branch.
Did he know that you were in the back of his pickup truck?
No, he didn't. He had no idea, so that's why I spent the time in the canal.
How much of that time were you conscious for? Were you?
I remember two instances. I remember first hitting the water and looking around going, wow, this is an interesting one. Let's just get up, figure out where we are, and go home. But I looked at my legs, and they were laying on top of each other, kind of, I would say, awkwardly. They looked, I knew something was wrong, but I didn't know what. So I ended up, I grabbed onto the branch, and I knew I was in some trouble. Then the next instance I remember is rain hit me in the forehead. It was raining on and off, I think, throughout the 14 hours, and I just started yelling for help. And since I had broken my neck, yelling for help was real weak. So it took a lot. It took a lot to, you know, muster up the strength to get some kind of volume out.
And the trooper was how close to you?
Oh yeah, that's right. I always forget that part. There was an off-duty policeman following Chris while he was driving, and he pulled in right after Chris spun out and arrested. He brought him over to there was a bowling alley across the way. Brought him over and arrested him. But when the tow truck driver came to tow my buddy's car, the tow truck driver's like, I think I hear something down there. And the trooper's like, no, it's nothing. It's just like some kind of animal or whatever. So there was, the story got kind of interesting after they pieced together where I was and how everything, you know, talking to people.
So who discovered you? Was it this tow truck driver or did they just
drive away? Was, everyone left because, you know, I was on the other side of the fence and they didn't see me. There was an office building on the other side of the canal, and a guy came out and ate his lunch in his car rather than eating in the office, and he cracked his window and he heard a noise, but he passed it off as the off-ramp, but it was so repetitive that he got out, looked across the canal and saw the crown of my head. So he called 911. The fireman came over. The fire chief told my dad the only thing above water are my eyes, my nose, my mouth, and an arm. So they came over. I grabbed the boat. They half-sunk the boat, got me in. I was out. They couldn't find anything, couldn't find a pulse, couldn't find any breathing. Got me to land, and they found my pulse. My pulse was 30, and my body temperature was 88. So I was hypothermic. I had pneumonia. I'd broken my neck. But I was able to, when I came to, I was able to tell the firemen and the paramedics that I couldn't feel my legs and my mother's phone number at work.
So were you grateful to be alive or so angry about what happened that
The first thing that I said when I woke up and I was intubated, I had a feeding tube and I didn't know what happened kind of just because, you know, your body knows, but my mind blocked it out. So they untied my hands because they tie you down when you're intubated so you don't pull out the tubes. They untied my hands and they call it like a speaking board. It's pretty much like a keyboard on a piece of cardboard. And I spelled out, I am lucky, ?? So I knew I was lucky. I was happy to be alive because as an 18-year-old, you don't want to really die. But, as time goes on, I was angry. I wasn't angry at Chris, per se. I was angry at the world. Being 18, having your independence, and then having it taken away.
My guests are Mark Zupan, one of the top American quad rugby players, and Dana Adam Shapiro, co-director of the new documentary Murder Ball. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about Murder Ball, a new documentary about quad rugby, an extreme sport played on a basketball court by quadriplegics in specially designed wheelchairs. My guests are Mark Zupan, one of the top American players, and Dana Adam Shapiro, co-director of the film. When we left off, we were talking about the accident that left Zupan a quadriplegic. What was rehab like for you?
It was interesting. I was in rehab for a total of 3 months, I believe. And I didn't like going back to the room, so I always would stay in rehab and lift more or just do something to stay busy. Hospitals, I'm not a real fan of hospitals anymore. So to stay busy kind of keeps you, I guess, occupied, and you don't have to sit there and say, oh, I am in a hospital, so. Wasn't that bad though. Could have been worse.
So how did you discover quad rugby?
A rec therapist, probably about a month into being injured, came in.
A recreational therapist?
Yeah, a recreational therapist. You know, he'd take us sailing, he'd take us to the mall, just have outings to figure out, you know, here's your new life, here's how you're gonna figure it out. He came in, he's like, all right guys, I got a sport for you that you might like. It's called wheelchair rugby. It's like, ooh, rugby. This sounds kind of interesting. How is it played? He's like, yeah, it's full contact in a chair. Like, really? I mean, you can just hit somebody as hard as you want? It's like, yeah. It's like, oh, okay, sounds good. So they brought, they moved all the physical therapy mats out of the room and set up a makeshift court and gave us a ball, and we just started beating on each other pretty much. And then I started playing competitively when I moved to Atlanta in 1996.
I want to get back to your friend Chris Igo, who was actually driving his pickup truck, unaware that you were sleeping in the back of it when he got into an accident and you were thrown into the creek. My impression from the movie is that you kind of did not stay close after that.
We had a real tumultuous relationship, if you will. We'd talk for 2 years. We wouldn't talk for 2 years. I was really hard on him. I mean, he'd do anything. He was going to do anything for me. But, you know, each of us has to deal with it our own way. So we would talk. We wouldn't talk. We would talk and we wouldn't talk. But the movie, the good thing about the movie is it brought us so much closer. I know. I mean, I speak with him on a regular basis. He's like a brother to me. I have a biological brother, and I have Chris Igo, who's my other brother.
Dana, was it part of your intention to bring Chris and Mark together again? Or did it just work out that way?
Not necessarily to bring them together, but to explore that relationship. That was definitely one of the reasons that, you know, Mark is such a big part of the film, was because it wasn't just about him as a quad rugby player. You know, it was a story about friendship and forgiveness and the idea that, you know, maybe it was harder for the other guy. It really was a very complex relationship that they had. So we heard, you know, in the decade that followed the accident. And I remember going to the 10-year high school reunion with Zupan, and Igo didn't show up. And, you know, his buddies who are in the film and describe it, you know, say, well, he didn't want to be seen as, you know, well, there's Zupan and there's the guy that put him in the chair. And what's it like to live with that? You know, if the movie is definitely, you know, it's not a film about quadriplegia. You know, it's a film about these particular quadriplegics and what's it like to be their friend or to be their girlfriend or to be their son or to be their father. And that relationship was one from the very beginning that we were very, very interested in exploring. And it was really difficult to get Chris into the film. He thought that he was sort of be portrayed as a villain or the cautionary tale, the guy who, you know, again, the guy who put Zupan in the chair. Like, that really isn't the role that he wanted. You know, he had spent so long trying to deal with this. It was a little, I mean, I can't even imagine, you know, what he was thinking when, you know, a couple of strangers call him up and say, you know, can we put the most horrible thing that ever happened to you up on film? And so he was very resistant at first.
Mark, just as an outsider, having like heard and seen your story portrayed in the movie, it seems like it's almost unfair for you to have been angry with or hold your friend Chris accountable for abandoning you in the accident, because he didn't even know you were in the back of his pickup truck.
Right, and I didn't hold him accountable. The first time he came into the hospital room, I'm like, he had this look on his face. I was like, what's the matter with you? Everything's cool. He's like, whoa. He thought I was going to be pissed. I wasn't pissed. I mean, it's not his fault. But he has to deal with it in his own way.
You said you were hard on him.
I was hard on him. That means I'd call, I'd ask him. I'm like, Chris, you know, come get me. Just, I wasn't a nice guy to the people that cared about me. I was angry, but I wasn't angry at them. So, I mean, hard on him is just, it doesn't mean, yeah, you did this to me, come do this, come do that. I've never said that to him.
But it was more like, you can walk and I can't, so do this for me. You survived it.
No, not at all. I mean, walking and not walking I don't have people do anything for me. Mm-hmm. Being stuck in your house, not being able to leave, it's just like, hey, just do me a favor, come get me out of this place.
Yeah.
That's it. It's not, here, come pick this up or come move this or do that. No, that's one thing that I hate, and I've always hated since being in rehab. People start to try to push you. It's like, no, leave me alone. Don't push me. I'll ask you if I need help. If I don't need help, I'm not going to ask, so don't give it.
Mark, your girlfriend is featured in the documentary Murder Ball, and one of the things she says is that she thinks the mothering instinct attracts girls to quads. How do you feel about being on the receiving end of the mothering instinct?
It's hard at times, I mean, but she's so cool. She'd do anything for me. I don't let her. She's like, "You don't ever need help. I want to help." I'm like, "I know. You're not going to help me. I'll ask." 'Cause she'd give me the world and I kind of shy away. And I think that's frustrating for her.
You've demonstrated, you've been a part of a group of people demonstrating quad rugby for veterans from Iraq veterans who fought in Iraq who are now in chairs. What kind of reaction did you get?
A great reaction. I mean, if we can show people that there's stuff out there rather than them, you know, the guys from Iraq, they saw the sports. We did rugby and basketball, and they saw it, and their eyes lit up. It gives you, I mean, don't let the wheelchair keep you from doing what you want to do. It shows that there's other avenues out there to pursue, to go down, to have fun with, not just to sit there and say, well, I'm in this chair and it sucks. Well, yeah, you might be in the chair, and you may be in the chair for the rest of your life, but have fun in it, and if there's, you know, things to do, then find them and do them.
Mark Zupan is one of the athletes profiled in the documentary Murder Ball. Dana Adam Shapiro co-directed and co-produced the film. They'll be back in the second half of the show. You can see clips from Murder Ball at our website, freshair.com. I'm Terry Grossen. This is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from this and other NPR member stations and from Barnes & Noble, publishers of Holy Father, Pope Benedict XVI, Pontiff for a New Era. Available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. Additional support for NPR comes from the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
Coming up, we talk with comic book artist and screenwriter Daniel Clowes, the creator of Ghost World. He has a new comic strip novel called Ice Haven. Also, more on Murder Ball. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're talking about Murder Ball, a new documentary opening next month about quad rugby, an extreme sport played by quadriplegics in wheelchairs that look like they're from a Mad Max movie. The sport is a mix of rugby, soccer, basketball, and bumper cars. My guests are Dana Adam Shapiro, co-director and co-producer of Murder Ball, and Mark Zupan, one of America's top players who is profiled in the film. One of the issues Murder Ball deals with is what it's like for people who end up quads after an accident to, rediscover a sense of sexuality and to find out who they are as sexual beings once their body has been transformed by the accident. Was that difficult for for you, Mark, to figure out who you were sexually after the accident?
No, being 18 years old, you're like, oh, okay, let's see here. You have your girlfriend at the time, so it's like, oh, let's try this. Oh, that didn't work. Well, let's try this. Oh, that worked. So, okay, let's take that and expand upon that. So, I mean, just being 18, I think, helps. You're curious at how your new body works. And, I mean, being a male, I guess that kind of helps, too, that you, I don't know. Yeah, you find things that work, and you pretty much re-educate yourself on sexuality.
And you still experience sexual pleasure.
Oh, of course.
And in the original article that I had read about these guys, Scott Hogsett talked about this rivalry between quadriplegics and paraplegics, because quadriplegics, many of them can get erections, and many paraplegics can't. And there was this this argument, I guess, that they were having, because paraplegics have full use of their hands, and quadriplegics tend to have impairment, sometimes very severe impairment of their hands. So they, you know, were talking about this rivalry and an argument about, you know, what would you rather have, erections or full use of their hands? And the quads definitely thought that they won that argument.
Ding, ding.
Mark, what's your day job like?
My day job is, I'm a civil engineer, so right now I'm doing land development and telecommunications. So you'll take a piece of property, just a, you know, 1,500 acres, clear it, you have the development, you pretty much lay out the houses, and then you pretty much develop the infrastructure of that development. So you do water, wastewater, drainage, the lot grading, so everything drains properly, and you build a subdivision.
So what's your training and weightlifting regimen like now?
I'll work probably 10 hours a day, and then after that, I will go to the gym and lift for an hour and a half to 2 hours. I then, in season, I'll hop in my rugby chair. It's kind of funny. I was talking to Dana, I think it was maybe 2 months ago, 3 months ago, and he's like, so what are you doing? I was like, oh, I just got home from lifting. He's like, dude, it's like 9:30, 10 o'clock. I was like, yeah, what are you going to do now? I'm going to go hop in my chair. He's like, what? Don't call me. He's like, don't call me when you get in, because it'll be like midnight. And, I mean, that's pretty much the regimen. You have to, I got to pay the mortgage, so I got to work. I got to train, because to be on the top of your game, you have to be, you know, in shape and what have you. But, you know, personal relationships will suffer just from the fact that there's not a lot of time to do other things but to train and to work and to eat and maybe get a couple hours of sleep, if you will.
So how much power do you have in your arms?
How much power?
Yeah.
Quite a bit. I mean, my arms work real well. They're just, my hands are the things that are impaired.
Is that unusual for someone who's a quadriplegic to have arms that are powerful but hands that aren't? It just seems to me you're exceptionally strong.
Well, yeah, I'm as strong as I am because I work at being mm-hmm. strong. But the thing with quadriplegics is Christopher Reeve broke his neck at C1, C2. The lower you break your neck, the more function you have. So I broke my neck C6, C7. So I have pretty much full use of my arms. All my muscles in my arms work, bicep, tricep, forearms. It's just my hands aren't as strong. And if you go up more, if you break C5, C6, then you'll probably lose maybe the use of a tricep. And it all depends upon if you sever your spine or if it's a complete or an incomplete injury. Sever your spine, you'd be a complete injury, and you're not going to have any return below your injury level. But incomplete's kind of like a frayed electrical cord. Certain impulses get through, certain impulses don't get through. So that's pretty much how it works.
But officially, you would be described as a quadriplegic?
Yeah, but you break your neck anywhere from C1 to C7, you're quadriplegic.
I see.
Anything below T1 and down, you're classified as a paraplegic. There's a the biggest misconception is quadriplegic does not mean no use of all four limbs. It means impairment in all four limbs.
So Dana, having made this movie, Murder Ball, do you work out more than you did before making it?
Do I work out physically?
Uh-huh.
Oh, no.
I mean, you certainly had people set a good example for you.
Yeah. No, I don't work out any more than I did. I play racquetball now, but I don't lift weights. And Zupan, actually, I always feel very unhealthy around Zupan. You know, we go to the restaurant, and I get the fried chicken, and he gets the grilled, and I feel bad.
Okay, thanks to both of you for talking with us.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Mark Zupan is one of the athletes profiled in the documentary Murderball. Dana Adam Shapiro co-directed and co-produced the film. Shapiro also has a new novel, his first that was just published, called The Every Boy. Murderball opens next month. You can see clips from Murderball at our website, freshair.com. Coming up, comic book artist and screenwriter Daniel Clowes, the creator of Ghost World, talks about his new comic strip novel, Ice Haven. This is Fresh Air. My guest is comic book artist and screenwriter Daniel Clowes. His comic book series, Ghost World, was adapted into a 2001 film of the same name, which starred Scarlett Johansson and Thora Birch as best friends just out of high school, trying to figure out what to do next. Clowes co-wrote the screenplay with Terry Zwigoff, who also directed the film. They've collaborated on a new movie scheduled to open in the fall called Art School Confidential, based on Clowes' memories of art school. His comic book series, 8-Ball, was described in Salon.com as mercilessly taking on middle-class conformity, artistic pretension, teen angst, cartoonists, hipsters, the horrors of adulthood, proselytizing Christians, sports fans, sexual banality, and, perhaps most consistently, Clowes himself. The graphic novelist Chris Ware called Clowes easily the best cartoonist in America and said, somehow he's able to blend satire and sympathy, two sensibilities which are generally mutually exclusive. Daniel Clowes has a new book, a comic strip novel called Ice Haven. Daniel Clowes, welcome back to Fresh Air. Where do you imagine Ice Haven as being? And describe the town to us.
Ice Haven is a fictional Midwestern town. I think of it as existing somewhere in that region of states around Illinois, somewhere in either Wisconsin, Michigan, or possibly Minnesota. It's the kind of place that has little resort towns that nobody quite ever goes to, or that might have been popular at one point, but are no longer big attractions. And I thought of Ice Haven as this kind of sad resort town that possibly they moved the freeway or something and nobody ever goes there anymore. And that's where it came from.
Now, one of the children in the city, David Goldberg, goes missing. And a couple of the kids who were reading a comic book about the Leopold and Loeb murder, in which two young men commit a murder to prove their superior intelligence because they think that they can commit the murder and never be caught. So these kids figure that there's some kind of Leopold and Loeb thing going on. Did you read a Leopold and Loeb comic like these kids did?
No, I grew up on the south side of Chicago, very, very near the actual scene of the Leopold and Loeb murders, and it was an event that sort of haunted my childhood. It was something, it changed its meaning over the years. The first time I heard the story, I really related to the poor kid Bobby Franks, who was killed by these two guys, and then there's something about the story where at a certain point, once they've committed this murder and then they sort of realize that they've blown it and they're going to be caught, there's this period where they're kind of waiting for the net to close around them. There's something so emotional and so specifically horrible about that I found it resonated with me for years and years. And it's sort of this primal story in my life that I think about a lot.
Now, there's actually a character in your comic who points out that you have that connection to the story. And he's a very pretentious comic book critic named Harry Neighbors. Are there actually comic book critics?
Well, there are, yes. And every one of them thinks that they are Harry Neighbors. I you know, do interviews and things with people who are comic book critics, and they are all convinced that I'm making fun of them. And I wanted to have this guy who is a comic book critic, but you see that he lives in this really fancy, huge apartment, and he's very wealthy from being a comic book critic, which I think is quite unlikely. And then at another point, I realized that I had created this critic who is obsessed with me. It's like there are no critics out there who are actually you know, devoted to me. So I thought I had to create my own. And in some ways, he's very much a figure of comfort in my life. It's like I feel like, well, nobody else reads it, but at least Harry Neighbors enjoys my work.
So Harry Neighbors, the comic book critic, thinks that the expression graphic novel is a vulgar marketing sobriquet. But you actually have a very perfect description. I mean, on the cover of your book, Ice Haven, it says a comic strip novel. And I thought, yeah, that's what we should all use. Because graphic novel, if I tell somebody I'm interviewing or I'm reading them a graphic novel, unless they know what I'm talking about, they have no idea what I'm talking about.
Well, they think you're talking about Henry Miller or something.
That's right.
I mean, I thought of comic strip novel as a very specific term to this book because I originally got the idea from, I bought a collection of old Sunday newspaper strips from 1950 through 1965. And I was reading through them and I was just struck by, there's something so wonderful about this mixture of styles and intents and sort of tonal shifts, you know, where you have Mary Worth and that's very serious, and then it's followed by Henry, where it's sort of a light little kid strip, and then that's followed by Dick Tracy, and then you have Prince Valiant, and you have all these different things all mixed together on the same page, and yet there's some kind of cohesive unity about the whole thing. There's a, you know, they're using the same color palettes, and they're using the same, you know, implements to draw the strips, and there's a certain cohesion to it, this kind of internal cohesion. And one day I was reading one, and I thought, you know, there's a strip where I think Henry loses a glove in his comic, and I thought, how cool would it be if that glove turned up in Prince Valiant like four pages later? And from there, that's where the idea of Ice Haven came. And so it really very much is a comic strip novel. It's really I don't know if it qualifies as a novel at 88 pages, but it's a larger narrative made up of comic strips.
I want to talk to you just about the drawing style in Ice Haven, and let's start with the cover. I look at the cover, and it has this effect on me. I feel like I'm being transported back to, I think, my childhood. I think I grew up with so many images that come from a kind of similar place in terms of the colors, the forms, even the lettering. I mean, the lettering for the title Ice Haven, it's that kind of 3D lettering with like black shadows, but each letter is a different color. And the colors are, you know, like a blue and an amber and a red and a yellow, but they're all slightly faded. And I see that, and I think the 1950s.
I'm trying to draw in a style that just seems sort of comfortable and pleasing, that on the surface you just think like, oh, look at these friendly cartoon characters. I want it to really seem like a Sunday newspaper kind of a feel, you know, and I'm using colors that are slightly muted. I mix a certain mixture of sort of a brownish yellow into all the colors so that it looks somewhat like it's on faded newsprint. I want it to feel sort of lived in. You know, there's no actual white in the whole book. It's all sort of off-white, like it's been sitting around for a little while. I always say that I want my ideal place for my books is not, I'm not so interested in seeing them in the bookstore brand new, but I like the idea of seeing the spine in a used bookstore and the thought of some, you know, 17-year-old version of me in 20 years finding that and just, you know, saying, what in the world is this, Ice Haven, and pulling it out, because that's how I found so many of the books that I was influenced by as a teenager or as a young artist. And that's, I wanted it to look like something that already fit on a used bookstore shelf.
I have this theory, which I suppose isn't my theory, but just something everybody already knows, which is that the first images that you see, the first music that you hear when you're young, just becomes wired into your brain, and you can't help yourself against responding to that. I mean, you just absolutely respond to that. Can you describe some of the images that you grew up with that you think are wired in you?
Well, I luckily had an older brother who was kind of a media junkie in the kind of the pre-television days, and so he had stacks of old comic books, especially, which that was my only sort of source of entertainment as a kid. We didn't have a TV until I was much older, and so I would just sit in my room and read through these comic books that I actually could not even read. I was just sort of trying to figure out the narratives from looking at the pictures. And there were, along with that, there were old detective novels and science fiction digests that always had weird, enigmatic, lurid covers and things, all these things that had such strong imagery that promised such interesting worlds and interesting stories. And then, you know, then later I would grow up and actually read these things, and they never quite delivered. And I've always felt that in my work I was trying to kind of deliver on the promise of those images.
So did you use a lot of crayons when you were young, and did that like permanently affect your sense of what the colors in the world are?
Yeah, and I remember being very, very frustrated by crayons. They never had the colors I wanted, and it was never right. I really wanted these specific colors, and I learned at a very young age how to sort of crudely mix colors, and I would make my own shades of green, and they'd always wind up looking really muddy and brown and gray. And I look back at all my old coloring books, and they're really unbelievably hideous. They're really all kind of overworked and muddy and awful. So.
Now, you're working on a new movie called Art School Confidential.
Yes.
And which is based on a comic that you did, on a story in a comic that you did. You went to art school. Did you not hit it off in art school?
No, I have very mixed feelings about it. I went to art school in the late 70s in New York. And, you know, I went to art school wanting to draw the kind of comics that I draw now, although there really was no market in the world for such a thing. And none of my professors really understood what I was going for at all. These were all guys who had come of age in the 40s and 50s and who were still very in the world of abstract expressionism, or the ones who were slightly younger were in the throes of the 70s and conceptual art and all the many, many different little variants of the artistic styles that sort of, you know, fractured out into a million permutations in that during that decade, and they had no idea why I would do something as literal as a narrative comic strip, and it was very frustrating. So I learned to meet other people who kind of understood what I was doing, other students, and from them I learned the things I needed to learn, and sort of learned what was working and what wasn't working, and what was funny and wasn't funny, and from that, I learned a lot. So it's in retrospect, it was actually a very good experience. But I didn't really need to pay the tuition. I should have just, you know, sort of hung around the dorm and met other kids.
My guest is comic book artist and screenwriter Daniel Clowes. His new comic strip novel is called Ice Haven. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Daniel Clowes. His new comic strip novel is called Ice Haven. He collaborated with Terry Zwigoff on the movie Ghost World, which was based on a Clowes comic book series. Zwigoff and Clowes have a new movie coming out in the fall called Art School Confidential, based on Clowes' memories of art school. Did drawing the human body and all the anatomy that you learn in art school help you with comics?
It did to some degree, although drawing the naked body is I'm sure that's very useful for drawing superheroes who are essentially naked, but I like to draw, you know, schlubby guys in ill-fitting clothes. I remember one time we didn't have a nude model, like they didn't show up, and the teacher tried to get a volunteer from class to pose sort of semi-nude, and nobody would do it. So we had to draw clothed models, and that was the best week I ever had in art school. I kept praying that would happen ever again, and it never quite did. So I had to sort of get in my drawing, you know, on the side, and I did a lot of drawing on the subway. There were a lot of sort of early models for my characters on the New York subway in the late 70s.
But there is some nudity in your comics. And for instance, in your book, David Boring, the character says that in some ways he longs for the quote, old days when fetishes were applied to handkerchiefs and petticoats rather than directly to the frail physical form that can never live up to the embellished perfection of our ideals. And I'm wondering if that observation applies to you as an artist, if you ever kind of wish as an artist that there were still as many fetishes surrounding, like, you know, petticoats and handkerchiefs and so on, because they'd give you more to draw. And I'm thinking, you know, that there's a whole press actually that's dedicated now to, like, fetish graphics from the 50s.
Oh, many of them, yeah.
Yeah.
No, there's a great... I think that came from reading this great book called Psychopathia Sexualis by Kraft Ebing, which was just a compendium of you know, sexual neuroses. And some of them were incredibly mild for today. You know, it's just sort of like mild homosexuality. And those were lumped in with some of the most gruesome and odd, you know, forms of cannibalism and things like that. But mixed in, there are all these really interesting sort of lost fetishes, and I found that so interesting. You know, there were people, you know, this is in sort of the pre, you know, there was no form of sort of public nudity of any kind. So people would apparently go to museums and you know, kind of get, like, rave over these you know, nude statues, and I guess that was quite a common thing, that there were people who were obsessed with statuary, and I just think that's so quaint that there were so many, you know, exactly like things like petticoats and handkerchiefs, things that people don't have anymore. Of course, those were fetish items, and it's such a charming thought to have a fetish about something that no longer even exists.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Daniel Clowes. He's a cartoonist and screenwriter. He does the series 8-Ball, David Boring, and he does Ghost World, and the movie Ghost World was based on his comics. In fact, he co-wrote the screenplay with Terry Zwigoff, and they've collaborated on a new movie called Art School Confidential that will open in the fall. This is the second screenplay that you've done. The first was, of course, Ghost World.
This was my first solo screenplay. The other one was a collaboration.
Oh, I see. So what are some of the things that you learned from the experience of doing Ghost World that you were able to apply to writing Art School Confidential?
Well, I learned the main thing I learned was that editing is a good thing. I learned that was very helpful in my comics as well, and that editing was sort of a global thing, that it was good to get rid of absolutely everything that you didn't love. And in writing this script, I had so many things I could put in. I could, you know, I could talk about art school endlessly. I've said before that art school to me was like Vietnam to Oliver Stone. You know, it's just sort of an endless subject that I could go on and on about. And so I had to really limit myself and focus on the essential things, and I think that was such a good experience. So I feel like the finished film is really all stuff I'm very proud of. There's nothing in it that I feel is just filler or something that wasn't as good as I intended it to be. It's all very kind of worked out.
How has doing Ghost World changed your life?
I thought it would change my life a lot more. I thought once I had a movie out there, especially a movie that you know, it was not a huge hit, but it did very well, and it was nominated for an Oscar, and all kinds of other awards. I thought that I would at least have something to talk to strangers about. I thought, you know, if I was sitting next to somebody on a plane, I wouldn't, I would no longer have to go through the whole dull rigmarole of explaining the kind of comics that I do, which is truly a fruitless endeavor. So I thought I could say, oh, I wrote this movie Ghost World, and oh yes, I heard of that. And to this date, I have never met a single person who has ever heard of Ghost World in a public scenario. You know, if I've met somebody who's a friend of a friend, you know, they'll have heard of it. But I've never been sitting on a plane and talking to somebody who has heard of Ghost World. So it hasn't changed my life as much as I hoped.
Well, Daniel Klaus, a pleasure to talk with you again. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, well, thank you very much, Terry.
Daniel Klaus' new comic strip novel is called Ice Haven. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Schorock. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close today with music by Winnie Winston, a guy with a lot of talents. He was an important figure in the folk music scene of the 60s and 70s. He played banjo and pedal steel guitar, built his own pedal steel guitar, and wrote an instructional manual about the instrument. He recorded with Steve Goodman, David Bromberg, Rosalie Sorrells, and David Grissman, and made records under his own name. He also taught design at the Philadelphia College of Art and served as dean of the National Center for Homeopathy. He moved to New Zealand in 1995. When he died over the weekend, he had prostate cancer. He was 64. I was lucky to know him a bit when he lived in Philadelphia. Bye, Winnie.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From the Charles Stuart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society. And from the Kresge Foundation, building the capacity of nonprofit organizations through challenge grants since 1924, on the web at kresge.org. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Fatty Arbuckle, Hollywood's first celebrity scandal, and the first morality campaign in Hollywood. We talk with Jerry Stahl about his novel I, Fatty, which is coming out in paperback. Stahl is also the author of Permanent Midnight, a memoir about being addicted to heroin while writing popular TV shows. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.